Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this CFCA webinar, Couple Relationship Education and Counselling, Research Evidence and the Implications for Practice. My name is Shani Moore, and I'm a research fellow here at the Australian Institute of Family Studies. Today, we will hear about research concerned with the efficacy of couple therapy in relationship education and discuss implications for practice. This webinar is part of a series of resources on the topic of relationship education and counselling, and we will send you links to these after today's presentation. Before I introduce our speakers, I would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands on which we meet. In Melbourne, the traditional custodians are the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I pay my respects to their elders past and present and to the elders from other communities who may be participating today. It is now my pleasure to introduce today's speakers, Dr. Jemima Petch and Professor Kim Halford. Jemima is Head of Research at Relationships Australia Queensland, an adjunct researcher at the University of Queensland and a clinical psychologist. Jemima has a particular interest in promoting healthy couple relationships through relationship education and therapy, measuring and enhancing treatment effectiveness in individual couples and family counselling, and leading organisational change to support the adoption of evidence-based practice and assessment. Kim is Professor of Clinical Psychology at the University of Queensland and a registered clinical psychologist. Kim has published a large number of books and articles, primarily focused on couple therapy and couple relationship education. He works with a wide range of couples facing different issues and transitions. Now, I need to alert you to some brief housekeeping details before I hand over to Jemima and Kim. One of our core functions of the CFCA Information Exchange is to share knowledge. So I would like to remind everyone that you can submit questions via the chat box at any time during the webinar. There will be a limited amount of time for questions at the end of today's presentation, and we will try to respond to as many as possible. We also want you to continue the conversation we begin here today. To facilitate this, we have set up a forum on the CFCA website where you can discuss the ideas and issues raised today and share your own experiences. We will send you a link to the forum at the conclusion of today's presentation. Please remember that this webinar is being recorded and the audio transcript and presentation slides will be made available on the CFCA website and YouTube channel in due course. Accessible versions will also be available. So without further ado, please join me in giving our speakers a very warm virtual welcome.
Thank you, Shani. I'm Jemima Petch, and I'll be speaking a little bit later on in the presentation. I'll hand over to Professor Kim Halford to introduce.
Well, good morning, everybody, and thank you, Jemima. We're going to be talking about both relationship education and relationship counselling, and in that, I'm going to focus particularly on the relationship education, then Jemima's going to talk about relationship counselling, and then we'll finish with some implications for practice. Let's start, first of all, with the distinction between couple education and couple counselling. As suggested on this slide, couple education is targeted on couples who currently see their relationship as satisfying, and it has the broad goals of building commitment and further enhancing satisfaction, but a particular focus is trying to prevent the long-term development of relationship distress. And typical evidence-based approaches are brief, perhaps 8 to 12 hours of contact. And some examples of those programs are the couple care program that Jemima, myself and a team have developed here in Australia, or the positive relationship education program developed by Howard Markman and his colleagues in the US. In contrast, couple counselling is designed for people who think their relationship currently has significant difficulties, they're distressed. The goals are often to clarify the commitment about whether they want to stay together, to reduce the distress and hopefully improve satisfaction. Typically, the research-based or evidence-based approaches are more intensive than education, anything up to 30 hours of contact. And examples of evidence-based approaches are integrated behavioural couple therapy and emotion-focused therapy. While that is the sort of distinction, there's also significant overlap between these two approaches. Some people who seek out couple education do have some distress, and education sometimes uses a brief intervention for distressed couples. And conversely, there are some people who have very mild distress who might seek out counselling. So while they're somewhat distinctive, there's some overlap. What we're planning to do today is, first of all, to talk a little bit about the changing context in which couple relationships exist, and then to spell out some of the evidence on couple relationship education. Then we'll talk about couple counselling and finish with the implications for practice. Under both couple education and couple counselling, we're going to talk a bit about the evidence for how effective it is, its reach or the extent to which it gets to the couples who might potentially benefit, and some new directions we see for each of those approaches. So let's start with the changing context of couple relationships. This shows a slide which is almost certainly quite out of date now. It shows the percentage of married couples across a number of Western countries who first met online by their age groups. Essentially what it's saying is that substantial proportions of people at the start of this decade were meeting online, and this has been growing exponentially. It's quite likely now that more than half of all couples meet online. So a lot of the relationship action is online, and that's going to be a theme that comes through some of the other points that we'll make today. Another important shift in couple relationships over the last generation or so has been the important rise of cohabitation, either as a prelude or as an alternative to marriage. This shows the proportion of all couple households in the US, Canada, and Australia that were cohabiting rather than married in 1970 in the dark blue and 2005 in the lighter blue. What you can see is there's been a dramatic increase in the proportion of all households that are cohabiting rather than married. Many of these couples are cohabiting and might then go on to marry. About 80% of couples who marry in Australia live together for some period of time before they marry. But others are choosing cohabitation as an alternative to marriage. And that's increasingly common amongst older age groups, interestingly. So we see a lot of people in the 50 plus age group who've been either widowed or divorced who choose to cohabit rather than marry a second partner. One implication of this for relationship education is around the issue of timing. Traditionally in the 20th century, the way in which relationships developed were that people met through face-to-face interactions, developed a more serious relationship, signalled their commitment through becoming engaged, then got married and often moved in together, and then they would parent subsequent to that. Relationship education as an early intervention really developed with a focus on engaged couples because that was seen at the classic point in which the committed couple relationship began. However, when you look at the 21st century, you find that there's much more diversity in how people come into relationships. Many people are meeting online as well as meeting through social networks. They date. The majority of people will cohabit before they decide to whether or not they're to marry. That about 30% of couples who have a child together are cohabiting rather than married for their first child. So often people are parenting without getting married. And they may or may not get married at some point along this way. We also see increasing divorce rates. So many people are separating, many more than there were 40 or 50 years ago. And so there's a lot more people who are then repartnering and forming step families. So you can see there's a lot more diversity in the current situation than there was. And one implication for relationship education is that we might target a variety of different points here across the different developmental trajectories towards a committed relationship where we might have relationship education. For example, we might look at people who are planning to cohabit and offer them brief interventions to help them make an informed choice about whether or what not they want to move in together. We might help people with the transition to parenthood. We might work with people who are separating to try and assist them to co-parent more effectively. Or we might look at people who are repartnering and the unique challenges of step families. So all of that's really saying that the trajectories into committed relationships are quite different. And whereas relationship education started really focused on engaged couples, now we're looking at a much more diverse array of windows of opportunity to offer relationship education to couples. So let's look at relationship education and its effects. There have been now well over 100 trials of relationship education. And this slide shows a meta-analysis which summarises the results across all of those studies. It shows in standard deviations the change in relationship satisfaction for people from pre to post receiving relationship education and the maintenance of those effects across 6 months in a couple of hundred studies. In essence, what it says is there's a small increase in relationship satisfaction on average for couples when they go through relationship education, and that's sustained fairly well for 6 months. Some people suggest this means relationship education is a fairly weak intervention because the effect sizes are small. But another way of interpreting this is that there may be some couples who benefit more than others. In this slide, we've summarised some different ways that you might target and offer relationship education. I'd like to walk you through it. We talk about the idea of universal, selective and indicated relationship education. The idea of universal education is that we offer it to all couples, irrespective of their background or stage of life. We would expect that many of those couples would do quite well even without relationship education, because there are lots of people who do have satisfying relationships without going to psychologists or relationship educators or social workers. So we might expect there that the immediate effects, if people come in and they're reasonably happy, are fairly small on how satisfied they are. And again, because many people will do well, the relationship education effects overall that we detect might be quite small. On the other hand, we might try and be selective about who we offer relationship education to and try and pick out couples who we think are particularly likely to struggle to maintain relationship satisfaction. We've called them high-risk couples. For example, people whose parents divorced are themselves more likely to divorce. People forming step-families often struggle to maintain relationships long-term to a greater extent than people in forming their first relationships. So we can, at least to some extent, identify people who are more likely to struggle to maintain their relationships. And if we screen couples and selectively offer relationship education, even if they're satisfied at the start, we might expect to see some modest increase in the short term, but in the long term, we'd expect to see a larger effect for those high-risk couples than we would if we offered relationship education universally. Finally, we might focus on what's called indicated interventions. This refers to the idea that people are already showing some signs of distress. So they tend to be a higher representation of high-risk couples. Their initial satisfaction before education is a little bit lower. And so there we might expect to see a larger immediate response to education and perhaps a positive long-term benefit. So the sort of thing that my colleague Guy Bodenman and I were suggesting in a paper that we wrote describing these is that you might expect to see the major long-term effects of relationship education for selective offerings of education and the major short-term effects for indicated interventions. To illustrate what that means, this shows the trajectory of relationship satisfaction in couples having their first child together. Again, it's a meta-analysis summarising 37 different studies that followed people from around the time of the birth of the child to 12 months later. And the downward slopes reflect that the men and women are both showing an average decline in relationship satisfaction across the first 12 months. This has been very well replicated, that if you have a first child, that often puts a strain on the couple relationship. But it's not the same strain for all couples. This shows a study that Jemima and I did together where we tracked 250 couples from 3 months before the birth of their first child to about 2.5 years later. So it's about 3 years' time altogether. And we looked at couples and stratified them into high and low risk for future relationship problems. High risk meant they had more than three of the following risk indicators for relationship problems. Their parents in the family of origin had been divorced. They had low education. One partner had not completed year 12. They had low income. There was some history of psychological distress, anxiety or depression in one or both partners. The pregnancy was unplanned, or there was at least one incident of interpartner violence. So if you have three or more of those, we regard you as high risk. Two or less, you're of less risk. And this shows the trajectory of relationship satisfaction for high risk in the red and low risk in the black from before the birth to 2.5 years later. The dotted red line indicates the cutoff on this measure for relationship distress, clinical levels of distress. Basically, what it shows is there's a decline in satisfaction for both men and women, both high risk and low risk, but the extent of the decline is much greater for the high-risk couples than for the low-risk couples. And that's true for men and women. One implication of that is if you imagine now you did a relationship education trial, it would be easier to show an effect with the high-risk couples if you prevented their decline because their underlying decline without intervention is much steeper than it is for the low-risk couples. So is it true that high-risk couples seem to benefit most from relationship education? Here's a summary of a review that my colleague Guy Bodeman and I did of about 19 different studies that had been done on relationship education where they followed up the effects for a minimum of 12 months after the education, and most of them had 2 or 3 years of follow-up. It shows in dark blue the number of studies that showed a significant effect and light blue the studies that showed a small effect. What you can see is the vast majority of studies have been selected. They've looked for high-risk couples and most of them show an effect. There are relatively few studies that have applied a universal application of relationship education, only two, and one of those found an effect and one did not. And there are only two studies that were working with somewhat distressed couples, an indicated intervention, and both of them had positive effects. So the research basically is pretty consistent that there is an effect, a selective effect, but we're really not sure if there's a universal effect. There's not enough evidence to show that. So now let me talk about reach. One of the ideas that people have come up with is to take the existing education programs and try and make them more universally available. There were two really large-scale studies in the last few years in the United States, the Building Strong Families and the Strengthening Healthy Marriages studies. Both of them produced really disappointing results. There was no effect overall for the Building Strong Families project, and only very small effects for the Strengthening Healthy Marriages. Some people have interpreted this as suggesting that relationship education doesn't work very well, at least for the low-income couples who were targeted here. However, a recent meta-analysis by Alan Hawkins suggests that relationship education, if you look at it within those studies, was actually quite effective for the people who had reasonably low income, but showed no positive effects for those who are really impoverished. I would interpret the results as really suggesting if you're worried about whether you can keep a roof over your head, learning to communicate is not going to make a big difference. On the other hand, if you've got enough resources just to get by, then relationship education might well be helpful. Another way of thinking about reach is how do we get people to come to our programs? As a colleague of mine described it, the challenge is getting couples in the room to take the sort of services we're already offering. However, what a lot of other industries have done is change the way they offer services. Bankers, for example, no longer expect people to come to the bank, but rather they take banking services through mobile phones, internet, mobile devices, take the banking services to the customers. We've been pursuing a similar strategy using online and other self-directed programs, which we call flexible delivery, to allow people to access relationship education at home. For example, Jemima and I have worked on a program we call Couple Care, which consists of 6 units, and each unit people look at a small video vignette which models skills and introduces ideas. They do a series of structured exercises with their partner, which culminates in them developing a plan for how they'd like to enhance their relationship, which we call a self-change plan. And then they have a video or telephone-based coaching session to help them apply these ideas in the relationship. It takes between 1.5 and 2 hours a week for a couple across about 6 weeks to complete, but you can do it at home. Does that produce any benefits? Well, here's a study that we published earlier this year where we looked at the immediate benefits from couple care. We randomly assigned people to couple care or control, and the control was a guided reading program. And we stratified the couples according to whether they were highly satisfied in their relationship at the time they presented or had mild relationship distress and indicated intervention. What the slide basically says is satisfaction jumps substantially for those with mild distress, and there's a moderate effect size increase, whereas it made no immediate effect for the currently satisfied group. Turning now to research on long-term effects, this shows two trials, one with couples in the early stage of their relationship on the left and one with couples who have just had their first child on the right. Because of time, I won't go through this in great detail, but in essence what it shows is we've got low-risk and high-risk couples in the control group or receiving relationship education, and it shows the change in their satisfaction across 4 years for the left-hand study and 3 years in the right-hand study. In essence, what the slide shows is all of the effects were for the high-risk couples, and we dramatically improved the outcomes for high-risk couples, but really make little difference to the low-risk couples. Let me now just talk briefly about new directions. So I've talked about the idea that traditionally relationship education targeted engaged couples, which made sense in 1950 and 1960, but doesn't really make sense in 2015. I've talked about different times that you might intervene, and I've given some examples of people in early stage relationships and parenting. I want to take the last example when people have separated and possibly are considering repartnering and just briefly describe what we've been doing there. We've been working with parents who are separated and who have a child but can't agree on how to co-parent and looking at how we might enhance their ability to form meaningful parenting arrangements. This slide here shows a randomised trial that we've just completed, where we assigned people to family mediation as usual, MAU, or a motivational interviewing enhanced mediation. This is where we taught the mediators to pay particular attention when parents were talking to them about when the parent said things about how they could change in positive ways to enhance their parenting or how they might collaborate more effectively with their former partner, and to get people to elaborate on that. And this shows the number of parents who reached an agreement at the end of mediation. Green means they reached full agreement on all of the areas in dispute. Amber means they reached partial agreement. They could resolve some of the issues for which they sought mediation. And red means they got no agreements at all on the issues that were source of dispute. What you can see is motivational interviewing basically doubles the percentage of families who get full agreement and halves the number of families who get no agreement. So we can substantially improve the extent to which parents in dispute can reach an agreement with appropriate educational interventions after separation. That concludes the key points I wanted to get through on the research on relationship education. So now I'm going to hand over to Jemima to talk about relationship counselling.
Thank you, Kim. Okay, so when we think about couple relationships, we know that most couples are happy. If studies look at couple relationship happiness cross-sectionally, so a snapshot in time, we find that about 20% of couples are unhappy. We know that the first 10 years of a couple's married life, and that's obviously where most of the studies have been conducted at this point in time, but the first 10 years of a sort of committed, cohabiting, married couple's life are the times where relationship satisfaction seems to decline the most. And this often coincides with couples having children as well, which we have seen from Kim Halford's slides, are the times where couples might be experiencing some stress around the inclusion of parenting obligations. You can then see that relationship functioning, relationship satisfaction sort of plateaus during those middle years of their relationship. There might be a slight decline towards 50 years of marriage. And this might coincide with the empty nest syndrome, or particularly around the time of retirement, where changes are again occurring in the relationship and the couple might be challenged by those changes. This seems to occur even if you control for things that might otherwise affect relationship functioning, things like income or education, number of children, the age of children. So we know that there is this sort of average decline, but that many people are happy irrespective of this. And we probably can see couples turning up to therapy or couples seeking separation around these key challenge times in the first 10 years, or perhaps even a little bit later in their relationship. At the moment, we see that about a third to 40% of Australian marriages are likely to end in divorce. The good news about this, though, is that couple therapy does work. There's been over 30 randomised controlled trials of couple therapy efficacy. And what they tend to show is that a couple who attends couple therapy is better off than 80% of couples who don't attend therapy. So that's this sort of large effect size light blue column here that you see. Bochum et al. Did a meta-analysis of all the existing randomised controlled trials of couple therapy. So it's producing a strong effect. These are couple therapies that are traditionally of five different varieties. There's behavioural couples therapy, cognitive behavioural couples therapy, integrative behavioural couples therapy, insight-oriented couples therapy, and emotion-focused couples therapy. So those are predominantly the couple therapies that have been investigated and have produced this large effect size. Interestingly, when we then try to translate those couple therapies into routine practice or look at what's actually happening in community practices, couple therapy in routine care is not producing as high, as large an effect size. The three studies that you see here by Halberg and Klan and Doss et al, they've all looked at couple therapy as practiced in community settings, and we can see lower effect sizes occurring. If we then look at clinical significant change, so that's the percentage of couples who move from the distressed range of relationship functioning into the well range of relationship functioning and therefore considered recovered, we can see a similar picture with the two randomised controlled trials studies. That's the Christensen et al. One and the Snyder and Will study, their efficacy trials. You can see that about 50% of couples in these randomised controlled trials are reporting being recovered after couple therapy. However, of the two effectiveness studies, so the ones done in routine practice, we're seeing a smaller number of couples reporting clinically significant change, a smaller number reporting that they're recovered, and a larger number reporting that they haven't made a significant change. So they're still in the distressed range. We're not quite sure what is causing these differences between randomised controlled trials, which I'm calling efficacy studies, and routine care or effectiveness studies. There's very few effectiveness studies out there of couple therapy. In fact, there's only three, and these two that I've got here, Doss and Halberg's two studies, they're the only ones that have so far reported clinically significant change. In contrast, there's over 30 randomised controlled trials of couple therapy. So is it just a chance finding that we're seeing such a big difference when we're translating couple therapy into routine care? There are some other hypotheses about why this might be happening, and I'm happy to touch upon those in our talking time later down the track. But some of the things that recent researchers have looked at are, do the couples differ on certain characteristics? Do the treatments differ? Do the practitioners differ in the way they practice, or are there other differences such as the way couples are assessed before, during and after the study that might explain some of these different findings? But I guess the good news is couple therapy works. The slightly concerning question I guess I have is, why does it work, seem to work less well in community practice? Researchers also looked at what predicts improvement from couple therapy. There's a few things that have been looked at here. There's the common factors. Previously, there was not as much, I guess, attention paid to common factors. We all knew that they made some sort of difference, but we didn't know how much they might predict outcome. But it seems that the level of empathy, the expectations that the matched expectations between the therapist and the couple and the congruence, they do seem to predict a better outcome for couples. The feedback-informed therapy, or the FIT approach, also seems to predict better outcomes. So couples who are offered outcome rating scales and session rating scales to complete during their course of couple therapy are also reporting better outcomes. And it's particularly the male therapist alliance and having same alliance, so if both female and male partner or both partners think that the alliance is strong, then that is what's predicting a better outcome. Just briefly, some of the alliance measures that are out there and commonly used in community practice and in research are the Duncan and Miller scales here. This is the session rating scale that you can see looks at the bond or the relationship, goals and topics, approach and method. And you can track at each session to see how the client thinks that the alliance is going. Looking couple therapy specific, there has been one study done recently that's looked at integrative behavioural couples therapy and looked at what predicted outcome for couples in that trial. And what they saw was that couples who had been together longer, and for couples where the female partner showed lower levels of arousal and less hard influencing tactics during problem solving, those couples reported better couple therapy outcomes. And during couple therapy, the couples who showed an improvement in couple communication skills, that had early change in the presenting problem, and they also showed a greater acceptance of the problems in their relationship, those were the couples who reported better outcomes. So we're starting to understand a little bit more about the mechanisms of change or the predictors of improvement for couple therapy, but there's still a long way to go. Only about a third of couples are coming to couple therapy. I think this speaks a little bit of the reach of couple therapy, the limitations of its reach, and some of the points that Kim Halford made about the way we're offering couple therapy is we're asking couples to find us rather than making couple therapy readily accessible in online formats or self-help formats. So this might explain why if you look at the attendance of couples to couple therapy, it's still very low. In the first 5 years of marriage, which we know is a time where on average relationship satisfaction is starting to decline and would be a key time for couples to either attend relationship education or couple therapy. There's one study here that's very neatly looked at a large sample of American couples, and only 14% of those had attended some couple therapy, but a much larger number are seeking some sort of relationship help from relationship orientated books or retreats and workshops. So we know that couples are looking and interested in some sort of form of help, but they might not particularly want to come to therapy. And even more interesting, I find that 60% of this group here, the ones that came to couple therapy, had already tried books or retreats and workshops. So couple therapy was almost like their third next step. Let's look a little bit of in the direction of new discoveries and new things that researchers are looking at for couple therapy. I think we particularly need to start offering online couple therapies, self-help therapies, and therapies that's got a couple relationship focus, but just one partner can attend. One particular example I wanted to go through today of a self-help program that's being trialled in the US is this one by Doss et al. It's called the Our Relationships Program, and it's a web-based program based on integrative behavioural couples therapy. So we know that what it's based on is a couple therapy shown to work well in randomised controlled trials. But it's all done on the web, and it is interactive and tailored to the people going through the program. At the moment, it is just in the US, but what you can see from the map here with the blue dots is that it has a very broad reach across the whole nation. The couples complete an assessment online, and then they can go through the program in their own time. There's about 4 or 5 hours of material to go through, and there's prompted couple discussions to have. There's very little professional contact during this program. However, the preliminary analyses, which I've summarised here, show that if we're looking at the couples who are starting in the relationship distress zone, their pre-post outcome measures are showing effect sizes similar to a full integrative behavioural couples therapy study. So they're showing an effect size of 0.8, which is as good as any face-to-face couple therapy. And you can still see a moderate effect size improvement for all participants. So it's very promising results so far with this online program. Another interesting way that couple therapy is being offered is changing couple therapy to address individual psychological problems or health problems in one of the partners. Because there's such a strong association between couple relationship distress and individual psychological distress and or health and medical problems, it does make sense to help couples or provide couple therapy to treat these individual issues. So there's two types of adaptations. I won't go into them in much detail, but for the psychological disorders up the top, what's been investigated is disorders specific couple interventions where the intervention focuses on changing the couple interactions that influence the disorder or different components of the treatment. One such study looked at changing alcohol abuse treatment, so alcohol use disorder was the individual psychological problem of interest, and changing that to include a couple focus. And they found, as you can perhaps see in this study, that behavioural couples therapy compared to a no treatment control produced a moderate effect size here of just over 0.5. And then, interestingly enough, if you provided the couple therapy modify to include some of the alcohol use disorder treatment components, and you compared that to traditional individual cognitive behavioural therapy for alcohol use disorder, you actually can see that behavioural couples therapy still outperformed individual cognitive behaviour therapy, which is very promising. It seems that the behavioural couples therapy improves the relationship functioning first, and then that later reduces drinking and drug use. But it also has some additional benefits, such as improving child outcome. It seems somewhat more cost-effective, and it reduced interpersonal violence as well. Lastly, I wanted to touch upon implications for practice. If Kim and I are going to do these slides together, I might... Do you want to do the first? I'll do the first one? Okay. We'll take it sort of in turns. I think what I've learned from the research and from watching couple therapy done within private practice as well as in Relationships Australia or not-for-profit sector is that there seems to be a difference between the research and community practice in the use of evidence-based assessments. A good assessment, I think, is crucial, and researchers often over-assess, but we can take some tips here about what is a good assessment. So good, brief clinical assessments that have high reliability and validity are crucial. We also want to have assessments that we know are sensitive to change. In the relationship area, there are a number of these sorts of assessments that we would be happy to recommend. I think what we also have learned is that regular ongoing assessments, or what we call progress tracking, can really help both the couple and the practitioner know when therapy is not assisting the couple or is on track, and the couple and the can be reinforced and rewarded for the good work that they've done. I think it's important to use that assessment to guide the recommended treatment approach. So the therapist and couple together can negotiate what sort of treatment, is it education, self-help, is it therapy, and how long does that treatment ideally go for? And then couple and therapist do need to agree on the goals and tasks of treatment. This is really something that I think researchers do very well. When they recruit couples and feedback the assessment, they talk about this is what the therapy is going to cover. These are the goals that we've all got. These are the tasks we're going to accomplish each week. And the couple agrees to that. Otherwise, they often don't stay in the study, I guess. But in routine practice, we do this to varying degrees, this agreement of goals and tasks and length. And I think that we could do that probably a little bit better.
So this slide shows a model of how we're starting to think about the way you might respond to couples' needs. We've identified people in terms of, first of all, the level of risk they have for current or future relationship problems, what their current relationship functioning is, and some different sorts of interventions that you might offer. In essence, what we're suggesting is if people are doing well, and we're looking at the bottom of the slide here, and they're at low risk for future relationship problems, that you probably don't want, as a system, to organise, to invest a lot of resources in helping those people. Very brief interventions. So things like recommending books, maybe a website that gives information, perhaps a one-off public lecture that talks about what healthy relationships might look like, might be enough to reassure people that they're doing okay and prompt them to continue to pay attention to their relationship. For those people who are at moderate risk and who are showing maybe mild relationship distress, then the research is suggesting that perhaps brief assessment and feedback can be a useful thing. So you can imagine people might do an online assessment, get some standardised feedback, and we've done research on these sorts of systems saying these are the strengths in your relationship and here are some potential challenges. That might be supplemented with one telephone call or video conference to give a little guidance on to shape that up. Or if people felt the need for a bit more, they could go to a structured program, but again, something that might be delivered either in a face-to-face format or online or in the couple care version where they do videos and exercises at home. But again, trying to make the intervention available in a range of formats to make it give it good reach. And then we've got folks who have high risk for future or current problems who maybe are distressed at the moment, and then it's probably couple therapy that's going to be the most effective. And we've identified there that range of evidence-based approaches. But again, we'd emphasise that doesn't necessarily mean that all of that has to be face-to-face traditional therapy. We might use online systems either as the entire intervention, as in the my relationship, which Jemima described, or it might be a supplement to face-to-face therapy. Perhaps you can do some of the exercises and watch some videos at home to make couple therapy more cost-effective.
So far, I guess the implications for practice when we're looking at treatment is after doing the assessment and trying to negotiate with the couple what sort of treatment approach seems suitable for their particular distress and risk, it seems that so far the evidence is suggesting using one of those five empirically supported couple treatments is likely to produce a better benefit than a different couple therapy style. This is not to say that the other couple therapies don't work. I think we just haven't researched them. And at the moment when we're looking at couple therapy as practiced in an eclectic sort of way, it doesn't seem to be producing as strong an outcome as one of those five couple therapies. That's something that I think definitely needs a lot more research, because we know that in routine practice, couples often have significant barriers to attend 15 to 20 or more couple sessions. Community organisations also have challenges in terms of providing that many treatment sessions in an intense way. So this is something that I think still needs a a bit of work. Tailoring couple therapy and couple relationship education to what the couple particularly is finding challenging is also important.
And last slides, a couple of final points. It's clear that the therapeutic alliance is an important element of particularly couple therapy. And as Jemima was describing, consistent monitoring of the progress of therapy and the quality of the therapeutic alliance session by session across the course of therapy seems to be very important. Therapists are not very good at identifying couples who are getting worse across the course of couple therapy, and this systematic assessment prompts conversations between the therapist and the client to make sure that they keep the therapy on track. One final comment that I'd make is a theme across both the education and therapy is traditionally both couple education and therapy have been very couple interaction process focused, looking at communication skills, conflict management, those sorts of things, without attention to the particular life stage or challenges that couples are facing. The research that Jemima's described and some of the work that I've described is trying to introduce as well some more specific content about the challenges couples face. So if one partner's depressed, how can the couple manage that? If one partner has a major health problem, how do they manage that? If the couples are making the transition to parenthood, or some recent work we've been doing on transition to retirement, what's some specific suggestions we can get the couple to consider about how to handle those life challenges? I think there'll be increasing emphasis on that sort of content.